made it beneficial or advantageous to take up the collection first. And let me just use it as an opportunity to express, I think, the appreciation of the elders for the very generous and responsive way that you have accepted the budget. You realize last Sunday there was a contribution of over $15,000, and I think that that comes by students and resident members alike accepting and appreciating what our elders are doing in helping us get on with the business of the Lord. And I just wanted to bring it to your attention. We don't say much about it. I think that there's as little said about giving in this congregation as anywhere in the world. I never have been anywhere where it's as little is said about it and as much is taken for granted, I think, about it. But you're to be commended, and I just wanted to make that observation. Just keep up your good work. We're doing some lovely, wonderful things all over the world, and I want you to be aware of it, that your part in it is making it possible. We're glad to have those who are visiting with us today. If you're visiting, would you raise your hand, please, so we can see you? Oh, my. That's beautiful. Great. We're thankful for your presence, and we want to meet you if at all possible. Quickly now, let me sort of bring us up to date and make one or two observations before we get into the lesson this morning. First of all, what I'm aiming at this morning is clarity. I don't care one thing about anything else. What I want is clarity as we try to finish off today and tonight the two or the four realities that we're calling the four pillars, or these four pillars that we're calling the four realities of life. Last Sunday morning and last Sunday night, we talked about the first two of them that relate to the appropriation of the good news to our own lives. Last Sunday morning, we noticed where the power is to live the Christian life. And we discovered that the power to live the Christian life lies in the Gospels, because that's where the glory of the Lord is revealed. And Paul says that we all, with unveiled face, beholding the glory of the Lord, are being changed into His likeness from one degree of glory to another. Now, that simply means that the power of the Christian life lies in becoming like Jesus Christ. It doesn't lie so much in doing as it lies in being. All right, we notice that that's where the power lies. And the phrase that we found and used, I find in the Gospels the power to do what's in the letters. All right, and then last Sunday evening, we noticed the lesson and the thought that we find in the Gospels also the assurance that we're all right with God even when we fail to do what's in the letters. While we're on our way from this point of glory up to His point of glory, in the meantime, while we're still untogether, we find the assurance that we're all right with God as we see how Jesus dealt with those apostles while they were untogether. And that's revealed in the Gospels themselves. And so these two principles, I find in the Gospels the power to do what's in the letters, and I find in the Gospels also the assurance that I'm all right with God even in my undone state, while I'm failing to do what's in the letters, while I'm missing the mark. Now, today, we want to progress on to two more principles that have to do more with the communicating of the gospel to other people. Having appropriated the gospel to our own lives in the power to live it and in the assurance that we're all right with God, having done that now last Sunday, and that in the sense of appropriation of the gospel to ourselves, today let's look at the two concepts that will implement communicating the good news to other people. I want to be clear, I want to be simple, not shallow, but simple, and so I'm urging that you help me with your response in the sense of being a part of it. I'm not going to be asking any questions probably, but I need for you to think along with me. These are four of the most important lessons that I've ever preached in my life. That's why I'm asking that you come back tonight. Even if you have to sit up here in this corner, I sat up there during the lectureship one night. I don't see how you people keep your mind on what's going on up there. And I want to take off my hat to you. You're a special breed. Those of you that sit way up in yonder, God bless you. And way back under yonder, You'll have to think extra hard in order to keep up. But be back tonight and let's get these four in a package arrangement. All right. Now, having learned that the power and the assurance is in the Gospels, it's frustrating in a sense to having come to that realization, to arrive in the middle of the Gospels, to come to the central event in the Gospels, that is His death, and not be able to understand it, not be able to grasp it. Now let me say that again. It's frustrating having realized that the power and the assurance to live the Christian life lies in the Gospels. In a sense, it's frustrating to get to that realization, to then stand in the midst of all the Gospels and come to the central event in the Gospels, which is His death, and not be able to grasp it. Now, it's in this sense that we're not able to grasp it. It was a Roman custom. The crucifixion was a Roman custom. It was a Roman type of execution. It's not American. It's 2,000 years old. It's not in the 20th century. It was back in the first century. And so we find ourselves separated from it in the sense of custom, of people. We're not Romans, we're Americans. We find ourselves separated in the sense of time. We're living in the 20th century, they were in the first century. And we find ourselves unable to understand, to comprehend, and certainly to communicate the horribleness of the event. I'm not making any bones about it. I cannot comprehend the horribleness of the crucifixion scene. I never have been able to, and I just find that it's not within my grasp to communicate it. I don't think it's within your grasp to understand it. And incidentally, we could say that had He died by execution in some other way, had He died at the hands of a firing squad, or had He died at the hands of someone who hanged Him by the neck until He died, or had He died in an electric chair, an electrical execution, we could understand it more, we could identify with it more, because those are terms and those are methods that are current, but we still couldn't grasp the horribleness of it, and in effect, these means of execution are not as horrible as the cross's execution. That was one of the most horrible, history says, and those who know what they're talking about, the most horrible of all human forms of execution. But I want to ask you a question. Does the power of the gospel of Jesus Christ lie in the horribleness of the crucifixion scene? Is that where it lies? Does your attachment to Jesus Christ lie in your ability to comprehend the horribleness of the crucifixion scene? If it does, we're in trouble. If our attachment to Jesus and our commitment to Him lies in our ability to understand and to fathom and to grasp the horribleness of the crucifixion scene, there's not anybody here today who will be very attached or very committed to Jesus Christ. And if that's where it lies, then we are in trouble. A very few people are going to be able to communicate it, for one thing. I think some actors might be able to. We've got some actors in pulpits today, some men who depend on theatricals in order to communicate, and I won't judge them. I'll just simply say it doesn't work when you try to communicate the cross of Jesus to people. Secondly, if the horribleness of the crucifixion scene is where the power lies, the Gospels themselves don't do a very good job, because there's not all that much emphasis and all that much stress on the horribleness of the scene itself. It just tells it and that's it. It doesn't go into all the gruesome details that the actors go into as it talks about the blood dripping down and it tells about the blood spilling, but it just tells it. It doesn't go through all the agonizing torture and the agonizing, gruesome details that many actors go through in order to bring you and me to an emotional high point so where we can get the impact of the horribleness of the cross of Jesus. The Gospels themselves fail if they're trying to produce an emotional response in terms of overemphasizing or emphasizing to a high degree the horribleness of the event. Furthermore, if the horribleness of the event is where the power lies, then we ought to tell about the crucifixion of the thieves rather than the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. For one thing, He died before they did. He didn't last as long as they did. Secondly, they died with broken legs. Jesus didn't have His legs broken. There are two or three reasons why, if the event itself and the horribleness of it is where the power lies, we ought to tell about the death of the thieves rather than the death of Jesus Christ. But you say, wait a minute, that won't work. The death of Jesus is meaningful only because of His life. And that's right. And you can say that again. The death of Jesus is meaningful only because of his life. Which brings us to reality number three. Reality number one, in the Gospels we find the power to do what's in the letters. Number two, in the Gospels we find the assurance that we're all right with God. Number three reality is that the central event in the life of Jesus, and that's his death, the central event can only be understood in the light of the central quality of his life. Now let me say that again. The central event can only be understood in the light of the central quality of his life. Now follow me, if you will, and see if you can identify with me in some experiences in my life. And I know you can, because I think this is your same predicament. For example, I had never been able to understand and appreciate the death of Jesus Christ for the whole world. I just couldn't get anything out of it. I know the record stated. I know that the apostles later say that he's the propitiation not only for our sins but for the whole world. I know all of that. I can quote those passages. I can go back and find them for you. But I'll still have to confess, as a Christian, at the time that I was wrestling with all this some 10 years ago, having preached at that time for 15 years, I still could not grasp the emotional impact, or I couldn't appreciate it, this concept of Jesus dying for the whole world. I just couldn't do it. I used to think that I was a bit strange. I used to think that I was just hardened and that it was such that I could never appreciate. It was like trying to get my arms around the Empire State Building. Did you ever try to do that or even think about it? Go out and get your arms around the new Benson Auditorium. Come on, go over there and get at it. Well, you say, man, I can't. My arms are too short. I know it. My brain was too short. I couldn't get around the idea of Jesus dying for the whole world. I can go over there and get a handle on one of those doors. They've got the doors on now, and I think the handles. I can go over there and get a handle on the door, open it up, and walk into that vast expanse of that auditorium. I can do that. And all you have to say is, Jim, go over there and lay your hand on that door handle and open her up, and I'll go over there and do it. Because I can, that brings it down to a scope or a scale that I can understand and I can handle. Now, the same thing is true with the death of Jesus Christ. Follow me now. Though we could not, and you can't either, don't tell me you can't grasp the enormity of the impact and the implications of Jesus dying for the whole world. You sit here, you may play like you can, but you can't do it. But you know what you can do? Follow me as I began to get a handle on the door into that great reality. One day I saw Jesus treat an unnamed nobody with the utmost kindness and respect. When I watched him turn to the thief who asked for a favor, and to that thief while he was dying, and as death stood impatient at the door of Jesus himself, Jesus turned to that man and said, "Today, you're going to be with me in paradise." The day I saw that, it hit me like a bolt of lightning. That's what the cross means. And I saw immediately then, after so many years of looking at it, I saw then immediately that Jesus' kindness to that thief on the cross was his actual death on the cross in miniature. His death on the cross was demonstrated immediately by that his kindness to that thief on the cross. Now that's really the thesis upon which we're going to consider one or two things this morning before I turn the lesson to you. What I saw in Jesus' action toward the thief was the cross of Jesus and his death in miniature. I saw him give up himself for that man. I saw him give up a part of his life. He didn't have much left. But I saw him let that man take whatever part he had left. I saw him bring out of Jesus Christ a kindness to one who could expect no kindness. And I finally, I saw it. I finally saw, that's what the death of Jesus means. You see, his death on the cross was in perfect harmony with the way he treated that thief. If you'd treated him any other way at all, if you'd said to him, "Now, okay, that's a fine thing you're doing. Where were you 3 years ago when I was talking about stealing?" Or had he degraded the man or belittled him or said something short to him or stopped him and Had he done any of those things, it wouldn't have rung true. And in the thief on the cross, I began to see a whole nother dimension of the cross of Jesus Christ. The thief served as the tip of that new dimension. And through it, you can walk into the reality of the death of Jesus Christ, and you can understand what it means when it says that Jesus gave his life up for us. And it does not end nor begin with the death of Jesus on the cross. It's demonstrated there. But what he demonstrated on the cross, he documented every time he came in touch and in contact with people. I began to look then at the way that he treated his executioners. Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. Instead of cursing them and reviling them and answering back and bickering with them, and he didn't do that. Why? Because what he did on the cross was documented in his life, always, with his treatment of the thief, with his treatment of his executioners. And then I've told you the stories about the woman taken in adultery and how he treated her. We'll not go into that in detail. Most of you are very familiar with it because it's been mentioned time and time again. How he laid his life down for her, lifted her up, sent her off in another plane of living, forgiven. And how he treated Zacchaeus, who needed a friend. And Jesus was a friend of tax collectors and sinners, and how he went home with that man and caused him such unlimited exuberation that the man stood up and made a commitment that practically was almost beyond comprehension. He said, I'm going to give half of what I have to feed the poor. I'm going to then restore fourfold anything that I've taken wrongly. Because Jesus began in those times, he was demonstrating how to give his life, how to lay it down for people. We find ourselves then pushed into this new dimension. Listen, I'm just going to have time to just mention these very briefly. But I'm going to pick three events that were not toward individuals as such. One of them was, but it's general. But look, if you will, in Matthew the 15th chapter, verses 1 through 14. That was the place where he stood up for the old folks. He got in trouble over it. They had been accustomed to sidestepping the responsibility that they had toward their mothers and fathers. The Pharisees were the ones that tipped it off. They were the ones that came to Jesus and said, why don't your disciples wash their hands before they eat? Why do they transgress the traditions of the elders by not doing it? Jesus turned right around and said, why do you transgress the commandment of God by your traditions? For example, he said, you have a fine way of contradicting the word of God by your traditions. For the law said, honor your father and mother, and whoever does speak against them shall be worthy of death. But you say, any man that says to his mother or father, what you might have gained from me has been given to God. It's korban. Jesus said, you hypocrite. You hypocrites. He said, well did Isaiah speak of you. And then he said, they draw near to me with their hearts, with their mouth, but their lips, their hearts are far from me. And he goes on and says some other things. Then his disciples, watching this interchange between Jesus and these Pharisees, they saw the effect that it had on the Pharisees. They came to Jesus and said, do you realize you offended those men, those Pharisees, when you said that? And Jesus then turned and said, I don't care. That's exactly what he said. He said, let them alone. They're blind guides. And those that lead the blind are going to fall in the ditch. They'll both fall in the ditch. Leave them alone. And he also said, what my Father has not planted will be rooted up. They're not planted by my Father. Just let them alone. I don't care if it does offend them. All right. There it says they were angered at him, or they were offended at him. He stood up at a time when he could have just let it lie, and he could have let the old people suffer, but he didn't do it. He stood up and put his life on the line and said, I want it to go on record, even if it infuriates the establishment, I want it to go on record that I am for the old people, and I'm for them keeping, I'm for the religious people keeping the law of Moses. He went on record as that. But secondly, in the book of Mark, chapter 3, and verse 6, verses 1 through 6, there was an occasion there where a man was sick, and he had a withered hand. And they watched to see whether he would heal him on the Sabbath, so they might accuse him. And he said to the man who had the withered hand, come here. And he said to them, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or do harm, to save a life or to kill? But they were silent, and he looked around on them with anger, grieved at their hardness of heart, and said to the man, stretch out your hand. And he stretched it out, and his hand was restored. The Pharisees went out and immediately held counsel with the Herodians, their arch enemies. They held counsel with the Herodians against him, how to destroy him. What was the matter? Well, he did this on the Sabbath day. Could he not have told the man, come back to me tomorrow and we'll take care of it? Could have, yes. But he didn't. He laid his life down in that sense long before he ever got to Calvary. Look again in the book of John, chapter 2, and this is the record of his cleaning the temple. He went into the temple and cleansed it. They said to him, by what authority are you doing this? He said, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I'll raise it up. He was talking about his body. They thought he meant the temple, the physical temple. And then later on at his crucifixion, they wagged their heads and walked up and down in front of him and mocked him and said, oh, you who would destroy the temple and raise it up in 3 days, come down off the cross and we'll believe in you. But Luke's account of it, or Mark's account of it, says they sought a way to destroy him when they saw what he had done. After they saw his actions in the temple, it says they went out and sought a way to destroy him. And Jesus Christ let it be known. These people, you see, the ones who were being ripped off by the establishment, and that's all you can call it. The established religion in the time of Jesus was a concentrated effort to rip off people. Jesus wouldn't have any part of it, and he wouldn't tolerate it to go on without his opposition. And he went in there with this whip and began to drive out these people, these religionists who were always laying burdens upon people, and they wouldn't touch them with their little finger. Burdens hard to bear. Jesus went in and drove them out because he would not allow people to be burdened and allow them to be oppressed by these religionists. And he offered this invitation, come to me, come on, all you that labor and are heavy laden, I'll give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. And in that broad sweeping statement, in that great invitation, he just set himself up between the religionists of his day and the people who were being exploited and just simply said, stay away from my people. Get away from them. And in John the 10th chapter, he says, these men are thieves. They are robbers. And they've come to fleece you. They've come to rob you. And you're not going to touch my sheep. Get away from them. And I'll tell you what, they killed him because of it. Now, the point I'm making is simply this. He died on the cross. That's right. But in the thief on the cross and the way he dealt with him, a whole new dimension is opened up to where we see that Jesus laid his life down long before he got to the cross. He laid his life down with the woman taken in adultery. He laid his life down for Zacchaeus. He laid his life down for the poor. He laid his life down for those who were being oppressed by the religionists of his day. He laid his life down for the aged. He laid his life down for everybody that he came in contact with. And you can check him out. What he did on the cross, he documented all back through his life. Once I see that, I understand what he did on the cross. Never could grasp it before that. Never could grasp it before I saw the cross of Christ in miniature as he was kind to that thief. And then it opened up this whole brand new, broad, magnificent, the magnitude of the love of God. As he was gentle and kind and loving and sympathetic and understanding to people who were being oppressed and ripped off, and to the poor and the aged and the children and the adulterers and the outcasts and everybody else that didn't have anybody. Jesus said, in effect, you've got me. You've got me. And that's what it's meant when it says he laid his life down for us. By this we know love, that he laid his life down for us. And we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. I'm convinced that the only way you can grasp the meaning of the death of Jesus Christ is to see it in the context of the quality of his life. There's no other way to grasp it. If you try to grasp it through the horribleness of the event, if you try to grasp it on an emotional plane that can be maintained, that will serve as the dynamic that will project you into the world for a lifetime of evangelism, if you try to maintain it on such a pseudo-realistic basis as the horribleness of the event itself, you're going contrary to the import of the message of the Gospels themselves. They don't spend a lot of time on it. The cross of Jesus was essential, yes. But the power to communicate to and to transform lives does not lie in your being able to understand the horribleness of the event. It rests on a much broader base than that. It rests on the very fact that the event itself can only be understood in the light of the central quality of his life. And once you see how he loved people and gave himself up for them long before he got to Golgotha, once you see how that this was just the way he lived, he was always laying down his life for people, then you can understand that this is just simply a difference in degree, not in kind. The death of Jesus on the cross just differed in degree, not in kind. Man, then the whole thing just lines up. It becomes self-corroborative. It becomes self-substantiating. And we see then, you see, him at a point whenever people could say to him, okay, Jesus, you said that we ought not to slap back at our enemies. Let's see how you react. They're slapping your face. Let's see how you do. And so he did. He said, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. And see what's happened. Everything that happened on the cross was a final concluding fulfillment of everything that he did before the cross. And I can understand that. So the central event can only be understood in the light of the central quality of his life. Now, have you understood what I've said? This will free you then from any either self-imposed guilt or externally imposed guilt by preachers, and preachers are good at that, that would cause you to feel like you're some kind of a freak because you cannot become emotionally disturbed and maintain that emotional degree of disturbance over the horribleness of the event itself. It will let you see, oh, I understand now what he did. When I see what he did to the thief and to all those people with whom he had contact back through his life, I understand what happened on the cross when I see what happened before the cross. And someone who said, if the heart behind the universe is any kin to the heart that burst on the cross, he can have my heart any day he wants it. I say, right, I understand that. Now, as we close, let me show you something else that will be applicable to you as a Christian and to those of you who are not yet Christians. Watch this. Just as the cross, the central event in the life of Jesus, can be understood only in the light of the central quality of his life, will you turn to Romans, the 6th chapter with me, and let me show you something that comes as a result of that? And watch how it places the cross, his death, burial, and his resurrection. We'll all bind it right there together in those few hours. It places it at the very center of both his life and also of the lives of those who choose to be his followers. Because just as the cross of Jesus can be seen only in the light of the context, only in the light and in the context of the central quality of his life, so your central event. And do you know what your central event as a Christian is? What is the Christian's central event? Where is it summed up? It's wrapped up in one event. What is it? Huh? I said I wasn't going to ask you any questions, but here I am. What is the central event in the life of the Christian? It's his baptism. It is the representation of his death. It is the representation of his burial. It is the representation of his resurrection, both immediate and ultimate. It serves as the focal point at which time that person died to his sins, at which time he was buried with Christ into his death, and at which time he not only experiences a resurrection into the newness of life, but it is a foretaste of the resurrection he'll experience in the ultimate resurrection, and the whole thing is centered into that one central event. Now listen, just as Jesus, the central event in his life must be interpreted in the light of the central quality of his life, what is it that makes our central event make sense? Here it is. What shall we say then? Are we to continue in sin that grace may abound? By no means. How can we who died to sin still live in it? Do you not know that all of us who have been baptized into Christ Jesus were baptized into his death? We were buried therefore with him by baptism into death, so that as Christ was raised from the dead by the glory of the Father, we too might walk in newness of life. Listen, your life, your central event, your baptism, which is the focal point of your death and your burial and your resurrection, it also only makes sense in the light of your life which represents the kind of life that will come from a person who's been crucified, buried, and raised. Paul says baptism makes no sense unless it is viewed in the light of the life of the person who's been baptized into Christ. If your life does not find a consistency with your death, burial, and resurrection, Paul says it's counter-Christian. Just like Jesus' death, had it not been documented by his life, it would have been counterproductive. I find this to be one of the most exciting thoughts that I've ever come across. Just as Jesus Christ validated his death by his life, so our life validates our death, burial, and resurrection. And Paul draws it all together and focuses it right in that central event in our life, our baptism. What kind of life are you living? Jesus' life validated his death. Does your life validate your death? Or are you continuing in sin even after having died, even after having been buried, even after having been raised? That's just a side thought, but perhaps it'll help you grasp the centrality of the cross and make you see really what the main message of it is. Today, though, as we extend the invitation, let me just urge you to think seriously about this thought that we've urged all morning. The central event can only be understood in the light of the central quality of his life. But I can understand that. Thank God he gave us that action that Jesus showed toward the thief and toward so many others to validate his death. We're going to sing this song of invitation. You may be here and you never have become a Christian. We want to urge you to do that today. There may be some who've just never done that, never expressed it that way. Or there may be those whose lives just haven't borne it out, and you need to make some kind of public or private confession. Would you do this, and would you use this time while we stand and sing?